And you're very welcome to another edition of Majority World. I'm Robbie Sinnott, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of social justice, global issues and things multicultural. You can email me at robbiesin@gmail.com. That's Robbie, S-I-N, at gmail.com. And I'll transfer the Near FM mail over to that quite shortly. But on today's programme, we're going to be hearing Joan Collins, who is an independent socialist, and Bronwyn Maher of the Green Party, and they'll be talking about the bin tax or the refuse charges, whichever side of the fence you're on that particular issue. We're also going to be hearing the socialist youth, Paul Murphy, is going to be debating Marx and anarchism with an anarchist, James O'Brien, from the Workers' Socialist Movement. And finally, we're going to have Tim from Tang, whose also name is Tim Stanley, and he actually makes straw houses and also runs his car of chip oil, just from the local chipper, which is fantastic, and it shows it can be done. Actually, we'll have that on at 5, and then we'll have the Marxism versus anarchism, sort of a look at that angle as well. But first on the line, we've got Fionnuala Sweeney, and Fionnuala was over in Guatemala recently. In fact, I think she spent a year there, and she's not long back either. So, Fionnuala, can you tell us, what are you doing there in Guatemala?
Okay, I was working with an international NGO called Peace Brigades International, which provides accompaniment or international accompaniment to human rights activists whose lives are in danger because of the work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that by having an international human rights observer by the side of that person, it's a way of protecting them.
Okay.
And that, in a way, gives them the space to be able to carry out their work.
So these are actually people whose lives have been endangered. Is that true threats? Does the government actually torture people, or do they put them in prison for human rights activities?
Yes. Well, I suppose Guatemala is a country that has a very violent history because it suffered from, say about 1956, it's had quite a violent civil war, largely because of the huge gap that exists between the rich and the poor. I think there's some crazy statistic that 70% of the land is in the hands of 3% of the population. So there's always been a struggle because of that inequality. And that 3% who own the whole land are determined to hold on to it. And so anyone who speaks out and demands their rights gets in the way of the wealth of these people. And because it's a violent culture, the idea is to just get rid of them as quickly as possible. So it suffered a civil war up until about 1996, and there was huge human rights violations committed then. There was genocide against the Maya population. And during the 1980s, I think there was 100 human rights activists or left-wing politicians or students or trade unionists disappeared every month. And when they say disappeared, it's usually that they're kidnapped and killed.
And U.S. sponsored by the U.S. Reagan regime.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So although a peace agreement was signed, it was signed largely because I think the revolutionary movement was completely decimated because in a large part of the U.S. funding that they were receiving. So while there was peace, the violent culture and the idea that this 3% rich can continue repressing the poor to keep on to their wealth continues in Guatemala even today. And while the violence isn't as overt in that they're not killing people as obviously, let's say, human rights activists continue to receive death threats, they're under surveillance, in some cases they are kidnapped and their family members are threatened, they're defamed in the media. So they've very little space and able to continue doing their work.
Is there no reform whatsoever? Like, there's this guy at the moment, Berger Perdamo, and there was somebody actually, well, just before he got in, there was a guy who was a friend of Rios Montt, who was one of the big dictators in the 80s, the friend of democracy so loved by Reagan. Mm-hmm. And this guy was actually put in prison for some of the abuses that he was going on. Or I think it was only for insulting the son of Rigoberto Manchu or something.
That's
like
right,
that.
But
either way, like, there does seem to be some reforms, is there not?
They're very superficial reforms, though, I think. I mean, I think it was a suspended sentence. I don't know if they were even put in prison. But it was a landmark event in that discrimination against the Maya was acknowledged in terms of the insults against Rigoberto Menchú. But the fact that there was genocide against the Maya and 200,000 at least were massacred, the state has never acknowledged that.
Okay, and to put it in context, Guatemala is only maybe 25% larger than Ireland, and it's got a population maybe about 11 million, but it's one of the poorest countries in the whole Western Hemisphere. And so we have 3% of the people. What do they make their wealth from? I mean, I hear it's got the largest percentage of helicopter ownership in the whole world. These population, they're so small, but the rich are so small, but they're so rich. Well, how do they make their money?
Coffee. Exporting coffee is one large business. There's sugar, huge sugar plantations. I think it's just the actual extent of the land that they own. And so they would own huge sugar plantations, huge coffee plantations. A lot of the sugar goes into alcohol making, so there's Guatemalan rum. And a lot of it's inherited wealth that they got from pillaging the land when they arrived, and it's been passed on down the generations. Corruption also plays a huge part in it.
Cocaine.
Drug trafficking.
Yeah.
And organized crime.
Yeah. So like, there's also, there's got this going on one hand, and at the other hand, you've got a threat of a famine after Hurricane Stan in the north of the country. But you were there while that Hurricane Stan hit, and what were the after effects?
It was very surreal in a way. I think nobody could quite believe what had happened to it. It was just 4 days of constant rain, and the communities that were worst affected were very isolated, and suddenly people began to look for these communities and couldn't find them because they'd been completely buried over by mudslides. And so there was one community, I think, reached the media. It was the most famous case where they thought at 1,000, but the whole community just disappeared, and it was about 1,000 to 2,000 bodies lost. Really, and they were buried under 6 feet of mud, and they decided it was too dangerous to exhume it, and so it's become a grave.
Fionnuala, is there any ray of hope? I mean, this seems so bleak and so desolate. Okay, we're also going to speak slightly about globalization and how perhaps the American Association, the NAFTA, or even the World Trade Organization are actually impinging on the poor people in Guatemala as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, in March this year, all Central American governments, apart from Costa Rica, signed a CAFTA, which is the next NAFTA. But that's a Central America Free Trade Agreement, and that is due to begin in January this year. I think in Guatemala's case, it's slightly delayed because of Hurricane Stan and the effects of that. But it is due to start this year, and it's going to have a devastating impact on the economy, and largely on the rural economy, because there'll be this huge influx of heavily subsidized U.S. grain, and small-scale farmers in Guatemala will have no way of competing with that, and their livelihoods will be destroyed. So people are very worried. But when you ask about a ray of hope, I think the work that I was doing, accompanying human rights activists who, in this horrendously tight space, amid a lot of fear, constant threats to their lives, they still have hope, and they're not prepared to give up their fight in the face of this huge repression. And so I've no right not to have hope when I'm beside these people who are suffering horrendous conditions, and they still have this hope, and they still have a vision of one day gaining an equal Guatemalan society where people enjoy their human rights, have something to eat every day, and are able to practice their citizenship. So, and I think in terms of globalization, while on one hand there's the negative effects, such as, you know, the neoliberal model and the whole free trade issue, at the same time globalization has facilitated networks between civil society organizations in the region. And I think the Central America Free Trade Agreement, civil society did mobilize against it. So they're a little bit late because all of the negotiations were held in secret, so nobody knew what exactly was being negotiated, and so it was only a week before it was due to be ratified that civil society mobilized across the region. And I think civil society is quite divided as well, in that each group works on their own particular issue, but seeing this free trade agreement, they all united and they identified a common enemy, let's say, and that's the U.S. and free trade. And so they united, and I think after the civil war in Guatemala, where demonstrations weren't allowed, and there has been a lot of fear amongst Guatemalans of going out into the streets and demonstrating because it was normal for that to be repressed. And suddenly in March last year, thousands and thousands of people hit the streets of Guatemala all over the country and demonstrated against what they identified as a common enemy. And although they failed on one hand because the agreement was ratified, on the other hand, it has created something of a strong movement who suddenly realize that they can go out and demand their rights.
Because in 1986 there was something similar attempted in Guatemala City, and the amount of repression afterwards and torture was absolutely incredible, really sickening. And for this, so this would have left an incredible impact. 20 years later, people are now hopefully getting the confidence back and looking for democracy. Where we can't show them exactly where to go, I don't think. We could be looking for a while, but it's a search for all of us, I think, in our own way.
Yeah.
But anyway, Fionnuala, is there anything else you'd like to add now, just before we leave it so and go into some Afro-Peruvian? We know Guatemalan music, I'm afraid.
Well, if anyone's interested in the issue, I will be giving a talk in LASK this evening at 7:30.
Okay, and we just say that LASK is next to Merrion Road, near to the Centre at Merrion Road.
Yeah, number 5.
And it's... So it's free in, and LASK, it's a fantastic Latin American solidarity campaign. You'll see the sign for it and all on the left-hand side walking down Merrion Road from Grafton Street, and you can't miss it. And have a good one if you go there. It'll be great, and unfortunately I'll be in here at the station, but have a good one anyway, and we'll take some music.
Okay, thanks
okay,
a million,
brilliant.
Robbie.
Okay,
bye.
On Monday, the 6th of February 2006, the Dublin Council meeting defeated a motion to start collection of people who hadn't paid their bins, to start collecting their bins in their areas, because the of hygiene reasons, I suppose, was one of the reasons that it should be put forward, and also on the principle of no second taxation. But we have to speak about it too, I suppose, that might be opposing sides in the issue. We've got Bronwyn Maher of the Green Party and Joan Collins, who actually sponsored the motion, and she's from the independent socialist, I think. So Joan, can you tell us why did you put forward the motion? Was that an accurate reflection?
Yeah, it was near enough, Robbie. On the 14th of January, the assistant city manager came out and said that they were going to implement non-collection right throughout the city within 4 weeks. He did say at the time that 95% of households were paying, which turned out to be absolutely wrong. The figures we got from the council in November showed that 39,000 households hadn't paid, or only part paid, and that 34,000 households had paid and 40,000 households had waivers. So we were looking at a significant amount of waste within 4 weeks been left on the streets, possibly in Dublin City. And it was also on the basis that we have a case going through the courts at the moment, where we've won three individual cases, that clearly the judge came down the side of the campaign in relation that the 2001 and 2002 bin taxes were illegally set under their own waste management plan. So those 2 points we were making at the meeting, and asking City Council to support that motion to direct the manager to start recollecting all the bins pending the outcome of the court case, and also in the interest of public health.
And the City Manager actually decided on of his own bat to actually go and not collect 3 weeks ago, wasn't it, that case? That's where the motion was brought.
Yeah, the government gave the City Manager a legal basis to do that in 2003 under the Waste Management Act, where for the first time in nearly over 100 years, and when the waste was collected on a collective basis by local authorities, he was given, and all managers were given, that power not to collect on the basis of non-payment.
Now, Bronwyn Maher, yep. Do you have any sympathy with the people, for instance, who can't see it? They can't bring themselves to be able to do this. It's so against their principles.
You mean to pay for their waste?
Well, that's one way of putting it. They say they already pay for their waste.
Well, to be frank, I actually support the, you know, people being charged for the waste they put out. I think it's a good policy. I think it, first of all, it raises awareness in the early stages of waste. I think since I've been elected at Dublin City Council, I've effectively voted in waste charges in the last two budgets as well. I've been part of the councillors who have voted for it. I think it's a necessary charge nowadays, considering the problems and the challenges we have in dealing with the amount of waste we produce. And it has actually had a good effect in that for a lot of people who didn't consider, for example, recycling, are now recycling more. So immediately it's had that effect. But what I do agree with Councillor Collins is there is lots of problems out there. Even just very recently, the Environmental Protection Agency issued their report for 2004. And they say there's lots of problems with dumping and burning of rubbish. So we're only halfway there in sort of getting to the stage we want to be, where people are actively reducing their waste. And also another important issue, which to me is the crucial issue too, that manufacturers and producers of waste are not being made to be compliant to this new directive. It's only the householders who seem to be, are being sort of required to comply.
Okay, that gives us three issues. First of all, it doesn't work. Second of all, it's not distributed according to ability to pay, like the fair centralised tax system was. And thirdly, that the corporate manufacturers of this waste aren't actually being bought to book for it.
You said 3 points there. They're not 3 points I was making.
Well, no, these are 3 points I've extrapolated from what you said.
Over the two, yeah.
Well, the 600,000 tonnes of waste that have been burnt, the EPA report that you mentioned said that people have burnt in their back gardens, are surely a result of having to pay for that waste if they actually have to.
Well, it's a serious lack of awareness of the dangers of burning waste. I mean, it's very, very it's not very, it's really dangerous for the environment and for people's health. So that's a number one issue that I think we have to urgently tackle.
So you just try to change people.
Not understand what they're doing.
Okay, Joan?
Yeah, I just want to come in a few of the points that Bronwyn made there. First of all, our waste was never collected free. I've never had anything free in my life from this government. I've also had to pay my taxes. I've been talking to my friends and work where myself and my husband pay over €400 in taxes per week. Where does that money go to? And it was supposed to go through the Raise Support Grant into Dublin City Councils and other councils to pay for the collective managing of our waste and our water and our essential services. Essential services are absolutely essential. They shouldn't be based on what your ability to pay. It's not a green tax, it's actually a regressive tax. To my mind, what would have been much better and what should have been put forward, and again, it's policy of this government been reflected down to the councils and local level, that, and even I think Bronwyn's own leader of the party, Trevor Sargent, made this point, that in Canada they have a green, a dry and a wet bin, and it's paid through central taxation in Canada. It's a very simple, effective way of dealing with waste, with a national strategy on how to deal with the environment. And I think if that had been brought in at the very beginning, because I don't think this government were ever serious about the environment from that point of view, we could have very easily dealt with it and brought very quickly, because people have bought into the environmental issue, because people, I mean, in working class communities and all over the country, people are quite aware that waste is a serious problem, our environment is a serious problem, and they want a better environment for their own children. But what has happened is that they brought that in at that stage, and within 2 or 3 years of the fourth waste management plan, has said, okay, we're going to go from 4 collections of a grey bin per month to 3 collections of a green bin per month and only 1 collection of a grey bin. The recycling would have been absolutely phenomenal. If they had put in the recycling facilities before they even did that, that would have had a huge assistance in getting them to improve our environment and to encourage people to recycle and separate their waste. And at the moment, and the point that Bronwyn made was a very good point about the producers. We only had a recent meeting, and both myself and Bronwyn and a few of the other councillors were actually appalled at the fact that real producers of waste are not paying even what they should be paying. They're only paying a marginal amount, and the only answer that the City Council has to address that is to ask these people in Repack, will they pay a little bit more? So and yet households have been forced into jail, and been not forced into jail on non-payment of bin taxes, but have been threatened with court cases and court actions and summonses and legal action in relation to non-payment of bin taxes. And we're actually paying for these people to make money.
So, Bronwyn, back to the original point there, yeah, that Joan was making. Is the Green Party policy changing then?
No. That would be... That would be an ideal Green Party position that we would have, and we would actually want to implement it. Say we were actually, it would be one of the key demands we would have if we were going into any coalition.
Centralised taxation.
No. It's a very, very detailed, it's called a zero waste policy, and you have to have lots of systems in place to be able to implement the whole policy properly. Unfortunately, what we're dealing with now, say as Green councillors on the ground, is a system that we wouldn't be entirely happy with. So we are making what we see the best calls, given the situation we have, to reduce the amount of waste that's actually put into landfill in Ireland.
Well, I was talking to somebody from Convergence about a year ago, and he said he actually followed the trucks dumping the supposedly separated rubbish,
yeah,
and they actually was all going into landfill. There wasn't any separation going on whatsoever.
Yeah, and it's very hard to... Well, we've brought that up as well with the managers in Dublin City Council, and they assure us that everything is going to be recycled as is claimed. And that would be a very, very serious problem if things were just being collected, sorted, recycled or not being recycled. Because also recycling is really crucial, because it actually has a good impact on climate, combating climate change. But getting back to the whole original thrust of this talk here today is actually charges for waste. And I come back to my original plan. My position is I actually think it's a good thing to be charging people for the waste they put out, because I do believe it's affected attitudes towards waste, and it's actually had a positive impact on the amount of recycling that's been going on.
John, would you not think if we just brought in a collection of 3 weeks of a green collection and one of a grey collection that would have a good and a better impact on people in regards to their consciousness and their idea about how we separate our waste?
Well, at the moment, I don't think we could do that, Joan, because we haven't got... Again, that's another... See, this is back to the original... Another statement I was making. People cannot recycle all the waste that comes into their house. This is another part of the problem. We should be banning packaging that can't be recycled. I don't think people could... I think we still have a certain amount of waste that's unrecyclable, which is a big problem in Ireland. I'm coming back to the real problem I see is we have not tackled the manufacturers of waste and the manufacturers of packaging. We actually have the powers under the 1996 Waste Management Act to force manufacturers to not to produce you know, cartons and packaging that can't be recycled. And why aren't we doing that?
But Bronwyn, might that not suggest to you that the 1996 Act hasn't been implemented fully?
Oh yeah, but practically the only bit that's been implemented is the bit that is affecting households.
Yeah, and also the fact that this stuff might be all going to the same landfill anyway. Would that not suggest
to you? Well, I don't know if that's entirely true now.
Well, at least it's happened on more than one occasion. And that not suggest that the actual real reasons behind this was not to actually be environmentally friendly, but to privatise part of what was public service. And for instance, if there's a family out there with three children, and they only for that reason they can only afford to have one household member working, well, they've actually, it's very difficult for them to pay the full charges all the time, with nappies and all the rest of it.
We have a very, very good waiver system in place in Dublin City Council. That's another reason.
It's not graduated, though, is it?
Sorry?
It's not graduated. If you're above that waiver line, I mean, you're paying everything VAT already.
People on minimum wage. A family on minimum wage can apply for it.
Yeah, but if you're on just slightly over the minimum wage, there's always going to be a cut-off point, and it's just very difficult for people. It's the same people always pay the PAYE, is it not?
Oh, well, then you're widening it out into a bigger, and I would be agreeable with you. I think there's a very unfair distribution of the tax. You know, the people who carry the most tax burden are the people in that middle bracket, you know, down towards the, you know, who are earning the less. I agree with you there. But coming back to I have found, and I must admit, on the doors, as we all go around, it has not been a major issue. The issue I have come up, people are really demanding better services and less packaging. When they go abroad on holidays, they see they're able to leave their excess packaging. You know, in the supermarkets, they're able to leave behind any packaging they don't want to go home. They see much better systems in Europe. And they also can understand why we have to charge for waste. Landfill is extremely expensive now. And again, I think more direct charges are actually better. People know exactly where their money is going.
Is the service better, by the way? Because I heard that North Dublin, the Fingal County Council, have actually increased by 25% their charges on collecting of bins. Because the reason they give, people weren't putting out their bins often enough, so it wasn't worth their while financially.
That's a great point, Robbie, yeah.
That's going to be a problem, because we're going to have to work a system around that. And they found that in Dunleary Rathdown. People are recycling so much that the income generated from waste collection is actually not going to cover the actual, you know, disposal of the waste. And we're coming back to my friends, the manufacturers again. They're going to have to cough up. They're going to have to play their part.
But Bronwyn, you know that's not the council's position. They are going to come back on the household and make them pay more. Again, you know, the report last year from the city council said that it would cost €490 per household for
a full service cost.
So if we're in a situation where less people put out their waste, their grey bin, that amount of money is obviously less revenue is going into the council.
Yes.
So what can the city manager do? If they're not going to go after repack, which they're not, that seems very, very clear, they're going to go up the price, which they've done already this year with 5% increase, and it'll go up more and more. And eventually the council will say, we don't want this, we'll hand it over to a private operator, when everybody has paid their bin tax, because that's been the history in other councils, that when everybody's compliant, then they privatise. And I don't really believe the call from a lot of people in there that were defending public, the Dublin City bin collection being kept in public hands. But I think all the points you're making, Bronwyn, goes back to the fact that I agree with you, but definitely on the environmental issue, zero waste, to putting all those facilities in place, but where we differ completely is that this is not a green tax, it's a regressive tax. How can you say that a person on €400 paying on a wage of €380, for example, which is the yearly bin tax, is paying...
That's the maximum amount they'll pay.
If
they put a bin out every
week.
And a large black bin,
if they put out a black bin every week, yeah. They have a big family and they put out a large black bin every week because of all the waste they get from the producers. Mm-hmm. That is a weekly wage. Now, that is not... And it's a pittance to the very wealthy in this country who pay absolutely nothing in tax, a lot of them. And we've seen in the papers the other day that, I mean, there's been a loophole for the wealthy in this country, and yet ordinary people are getting... It's regressive, and I think we have to be opposed to that sort of regressive taxation, because otherwise you're going to be calling for taxation on water, you're going to be calling for taxation on...
Which is going to come down the line. I mean, under EU legislation, we're going to have to start charging.
No, you don't have to start charging, Bronwyn. The EU legislation says that if there's no alternative... The EU legislation is very specific about this. If the government can they said it has to be costed and it has to be paid for. We were paying for it in our taxation. So you don't have to go back to people and make them pay. You can look at the situation and say, collectively, the government can put forward a very strong argument to the European Parliament that, yes, people are paying for these services through their taxation. We stop so much
sure
taxation.
Yeah.
We ring-fence it for our bin services, our waste collection, our environmental strategy, our water services, all these things. They're the arguments they should be making, and they're the arguments I think you should be making going into this, if you think, along with Labour and Fine Gael, that you can make those arguments, and you might get a bit of support on the ground, because you certainly won't get it before then.
Okay, Bronwyn, I'll leave the last word with you. I just want to ask you, though, that some of the services are just too essential to leave to just people paying as they come in. For instance, the building of the water structure, the sewage system, and all this stuff had to be centrally funded.
The infrastructure, yes.
Well, and as not only that, but also the actual paying for water. Can you imagine poor people paying for water when water gets even scarcer in years to come? Well,
But we're back again that water is very expensive to produce. Now, I actually would look very favourably at some sort of system of metering water. You give every household an allocation. This would actually penalise the people who use the most water, who usually are the most wealthiest because they've got jacuzzis and swimming pools and all sorts of things. I definitely think that should be looked at, because why should the rest of us pay for these excessive uses of water? If you go to any of the continental countries, I actually think this is fair in the end. The direct charges actually are fairer in the long run.
Okay,
our systems need to be improved here. If we're going back to the waste collection, there's a lot of problems in certain areas with very poor bring bank facilities as well. So people don't have the opportunity to reduce as much as they can.
Okay. Against.
And it's going to be very interesting as well when the court case, the Supreme Court, if it rules against Dublin Corporation, it rules against the government next year, it's going to be interesting. But that's one we've got to look out for, because
we'll have another discussion then.
Well, we may do. So Bronwyn Maher from the Green Party is a councillor. What is it, Donnamead, is it?
No, Clontarf.
I'm sorry about that. And for Joan Collins, who's Independent Socialist councillor for Kimmage Crumlin Ward, thank you very much, both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
101.6 Near FM. Community radio as it should be.
And as it is, this is Robbie Sinnott, and the text number as we have is 087-6944-500. That's 087-6944-500. And it's always brilliant to hear from you. And we go all the way on this majority world of ours, which is probably a bit Irish, actually. We're going all the way from Dublin to County Longford, and we've got on the line Tim from Tang. Now, Tim, there's two issues in specific that we probably go to the straw bale one first. Can you tell us a bit about straw bales and how it improves house building?
Well, it's basically straw bale construction is it's a simple method of using a natural agricultural waste material in building construction. The house is not physically built of straw. All that's really happening, generally in the Irish climate anyway, is that the bales are used as an infill insulation between a post and beam frame. The house is constructed pretty much as a normal post and beam timber house will be constructed.
So it's a great insulator.
And the straw bales stood on the edges in the walls are plastered.
So if, like, thatch for years ago was great enough as an insulator for the roofs, straw was used. So this, likewise, is equally good.
It is equally good. It's also, the other advantage of straw bale construction is that you can have a deal of owner involvement in the construction.
Is
straw bales are unlike other building materials. They're big, soft, squidgy, light things. They're not heavy, they don't have hard edges, and there's not close tolerances involved in the building.
Is it cheaper to build a house with straw bales then?
That's an iffy issue. It all depends on the kind of construction that you want to build. It swings both ways. There are straw bale houses which are considerably more expensive than the standard construction. These are built entirely with contractors and they'd be finished to a high standard. And then there are straw bale buildings like my own which are considerably cheaper than standard construction, where the owner builds it completely on his own.
And you were saying it can be fireproofed and all by simply putting whitewash. There was a guy down in Cork who lost his house to vandalism when somebody burnt it down.
Mm-hmm.
But that it can fireproof it simply by putting whitewash over it.
That's right, yeah. There's a really dangerous phase in straw bale construction. You tend to put up the post and beam frame and then you roof the frame and then you put in the walls. And that's the dangerous phase, when the walls are being put in before they're plastered. This is the time when the house starts to look like a house and people come to visit it. And of course, it's the greatest fire danger. The straw is really in serious danger from fire until it's plastered.
So can you see cement road holdings going out of business sometime soon?
I doubt it, because I still use cement foundations for a start.
Okay.
And cement is such a durable, useful material used all over the place. But I feel that their markets are going to change, and it's perhaps not the most suitable material for building houses.
And there could be some sort of renewable resource which is, can be used as well for a foundation, which could be...
Oh, there is, yeah. You can use lime cement. Uh-huh. You can use dry stone foundations as they did years ago. I mean, the world managed fine before there was concrete.
Yeah. So the next issue, now, so you built your house, or part of it at least, with straw, but can you tell us then about the next issue, which is really what we're here to talk about? And at the moment, Sweden has got a policy that says that in 50 years' time, everything will be run from renewables. One of the examples that they gave was ethanol for running cars, but you're actually running your car on chip oil and have been for quite a while, and heating, your central heating as well.
Yeah, that's correct. About 7 years now we've been, courtesy of our local fast food restaurants, having free fuel here in town for all of the farm vehicles, my father's house and my house, and our cars all run on waste vegetable oil. We just recover it from the local chip shops. We collect for nothing, whereas previous to that they would have been paying to have it recycled. And we bring it home and filter it and treat it and use it as fuel.
And how many miles to the gallon do you get out of it?
It gives identical performance to diesel. It's pretty much the same stuff. If you think about it, fossil fuels are really, they're fossilised vegetables.
So you don't really have to
matter that's decomposed millions of years ago. It's essentially the same stuff.
So you don't really have to alter your engine that much?
Not really, no. The only key thing with running it in a diesel engine is to heat the fuel before it hits the injector pump. A diesel engine will only run on vegetable oil if the fuel is heated to around 85 degrees centigrade or above.
And how do you filter the dirt out of it?
Rather ironically, I use a sewage dewatering filter. This is the big bag filters they use in sewage plants to separate the feces and from the water prior to treating it in their sludge plants.
At the moment, you're running your central heating off it as well as your car. Fantastic.
More difficult, believe it or not.
But you've got a bit of a problem. Excise and all that, the government.
It's not really a problem. It's we're a very small fraction of the market, those of us burning waste oil. And by the definition, we have to be. The amount of vegetable oil consumed as food is, I think, it's about a half of 1% of the amount of diesel that we burn in Ireland. So that it's difficult and troublesome for the excise to collect the excise duty that's liable on any fuel you use in a motor vehicle when it comes to waste vegetable oil. Vegetable oil drivers tend to use a bit of diesel as well now and again, especially this time of year when it's cold. You're running out of waste oil. And we also tend to use new oil from supermarkets on occasions also. So because we're using three different kinds of fuel, it's not easy to just record our miles and pay excise duty on the amount of fuel the car has burned.
But surely there shouldn't be any excise duty on it to encourage people to use renewable resources.
Well, that's a policy issue as opposed to...
practicality.
As opposed to the way the world is at the moment. Yeah, sure, there shouldn't be excise duty on waste vegetable oil. The government's had its pound of flesh out of that vegetable oil already. It's been taxed four times. You know, it's taxed the farm, it's taxed by the distributor, it's taxed at the retailer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to face the world as it is.
So
and our problem with excise, really, at the moment is that we have no easy method to pay our excise. We're most of us running on waste vegetable oil, people who want to be tax compliant. We want to obey the law. You know, we're not doing this out of, because we're saving a few pounds, which we are, incidentally. We're doing it because we care about the environment. And we want to pay our taxes. So you go into the excise office and offer to pay, and they don't have any way to collect the money.
So you're setting up a co-op?
We are indeed, yeah. This is a recent thing with my recent discussions with excise. I've been in and out to them over the past 4 years trying to pay my excise. And each time, first of all, they weren't sure whether I was actually liable or not, and they've been pushing me from pillar to post, and I'm still worrying about the customs man. And in our recent discussions with a man in Athlone, we decided that an excise payment co-op was the way to go forward. If we can present the Customs and Excise Service with a large group of vegetable oil drivers who have all clubbed together, kept good records, we know how much excise we're liable to pay, and here it is in one lump sum, there you go, sir. Then they have to deal with it.
There's probably, it'd be great if you could turn yourselves into a lobby group as well to try to get rid of the excise altogether. There's a way in which Ireland might be going in all the garages at the moment. There's a problem in actually distributing. Let's give an example. The Barron family down in Wexford, they produce, I think 6 acres will run a car for a year, 6 acres of rapeseed oil.
And they say right, yeah.
69 cents a litre, they say, it won't change regardless of war and all the rest of it. Good for the climate. At the same time, They said €500 to change to convert your car engine. But the problem they have is when people go up to Kilkenny or something like that, their local petrol station won't sell any of this stuff. So, you know, they've got a problem. So maybe the co-op could also try to network and try to get things together that way.
Oh, we could indeed, yes. But there are already 8 licensed distributors who have been granted an excise rebate by the government who are selling pure plant oils for use in cars.
Oh.
And people are prepared to travel some distance in order to get this fuel. So where there's a public demand, I imagine that the distribution network will follow.
And at the moment, we know that Statoil are leaving the sort of forecourts market, the petrol market in Ireland, and there may be Maxol and maybe one or two at Texaco maybe left. But it could be that quite soon that it will be very difficult for people to be able to afford to run a car unless it is on something like this.
Yes, I think that fuel prices are still artificially low. The way we treat fossil fuels in the world is we use a supply and demand method of determining the price, which is fine for unlimited renewable resources, but it's not fine for limited fossil resources. And so the actual cost of fuel, although we're paying what we consider to be a high price at the pumps, that's not its actual real cost when you take all the environmental issues into consideration. So I don't see fuel prices coming down, and I don't see people being more easily able to afford to run a car in the future.
Now, Brazil, Sweden and the US are turning towards ethanol. Is there any advantages or disadvantages that that has as replacement for petroleum over, for instance, vegetable oil that you have?
There are efficiency issues. Ethanol is somewhat less efficient than vegetable oil. What I mean is that to produce any crop, you need to burn some fuel in the modern market. We don't walk around with horses following them anymore, ploughing and things like that. It's all done with tractors. And there's distribution costs, processing costs, etc., etc., etc. And the amount of heat required to produce ethanol, the amount of fossil fuel or other fuels consumed in its production is much higher than it is for vegetable oil-based fuels. So that from ethanol you'll put in 4 units of energy and you'll get out 12 in terms of ethanol. So you're only looking at about a ratio of 3-1 or thereabouts. With vegetable oil, it's more like 12-1.
But it would take at least 1/3 of the land of Ireland, for instance, to run all the cars on vegetable oil. But at least it would be, if it went through the normal route, into the chipper and back out the back door, like you're doing, at least it would get far more use out of it.
Much more use out of it. And it's much more valuable to the economy as well. Uh-huh. In terms of, I'm actually producing, my chip shop has an advantage over the chip shop in Longford, say, because they don't have the recycling cost.
That's right, because you're in Westmeath.
So their business is actually benefiting from me as well.
Uh-huh. Okay,
and it's keeping things local. The local economy is benefiting.
Fantastic. Okay, well, can you just give us a few sites? Where do people go, for instance, if they want to join your co-op?
Well, our co-op is really in the very initial stages. This resulted from a discussion with the excise man about 10 days ago. So initially, you should email me. I'm timfromtang@gmail.com. Fairly easy to remember.
Okay.
Or
and I'm building a straw house.
I'm building a straw house. There's plenty. Just type straw bale into Google and away you go. Straw bale houses, it's pretty much old technology at this stage. In the, I think there must be 15 or 20 in Ireland at this stage.
Okay. It's definitely, it's comfortable, cosy living.
No, yeah, the fellow down in Tipperary where I'm building a garden room at the moment calls them super warms, which I thought was rather nice.
Very good. And during the summer, they're not too hot?
Absolutely not, no. It's got, you tend to, because it's got a good insulation value, it keeps heat out as well as in.
Okay, well, that's fantastic. Well, Tim from Tang, thanks very much for speaking to us again. We'll probably call back in another 2 years.
Okay, no problem.
Have a good one. Cheers.
Pleasure
to you.
Talking to you. Attento.
This station dull, boring dull. 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 This station.
Watch me now!
Yeah.
And on the line, we've got Paul Murphy from the Socialist Party, and we've got James O'Brien from the Workers' Solidarity Movement. There's a debate going on. I think, Paul, you might have all the details, and there's a debate going on Saturday. This is, I think, what day is today? The 9th of February, but Saturday is the 11th of February, and it's about Marxism versus anarchism. So can you just give us the details of it first?
I can, of course. It's a debate between Socialist Youth, which is the youth section of the Socialist Party, and the WSM, the anarchist movement. It's at 2 o'clock in the Earl of Kildare Hotel, which is on Kildare Street, and there are two topics. We've got basically two topics of discussion. One, firstly, on how do we organise to get rid of capitalism, and secondly, what does society after capitalism look like, which is, you know, kind of the two of the key things that Marxist anarchists would debate.
You would have thought they'd be pretty similar on the last issue, because Marxist communism would be pretty similar to the anarchist ideal.
Yeah, and the final, I think our final goal is very, very similar in terms of a stateless, moneyless society. But it's more in terms of what happens immediately after you have a socialist transformation society. In our opinion, there's a need for a workers' state, whereas in the opinion of the anarchists, there's no need. You can abolish the state immediately, kind of. So that would be the kind of the key focus of the discussion, maybe.
Okay, James O'Brien, that is an issue. It's just like after the Big Bang, what happens immediately after it? And let's say, what's so bad about the state anyway?
What's bad about the state?
If the state is democratic, and if...
Well, the state isn't democratic.
No, but if the state is democratic, and if there's accountability, and people can recall people at any time, and all the rest of it, what's wrong with the state then?
Anarchists would argue that, by its very nature, a state can never be democratic, because it's a vehicle for the rule of a minority. So that means you'd always have a minority imposing their wishes on the vast majority of the population, so... We don't think democracy is any meaningful term in that situation.
But let's say we've got referendums every other day, and people can vote when they want, and because technology is getting that way. So let's say the subsidiarity principle is brought to its fruition to the fullest, and let's say the jury system replaces the committee system in the Dáil. And let's say you've got, and so it's far more effective for coordinating, for instance, rail services between Dublin and Donegal, for instance, than would be an anarchist system where there's no state whatsoever.
Sure, but once the state is gone, it's not going to be just left empty. Anarchists would see that the working class would organise society directly themselves through things like neighbourhood councils and workers' councils. And there's plenty of things in society that need to be organised, like public transport or healthcare or education or whatever, and that... So the workers will continue to do that, but they won't need the state to boss them around whilst they're doing it.
Can that be efficient? Is it just very ad hoc?
In my experience in my working life, hierarchy is a recipe for inefficiency. You just get layers of...
I know, that's a different argument. No, I wasn't talking about hierarchy. I was talking about a non-hierarchical state versus no state at all.
Yeah, but anarchists say that you can't have a non-hierarchical state by its very definition. A state is a vehicle for hierarchy, with people at the top transmitting orders to people at the bottom. So that's hierarchical.
See, you see, Paul Murphy, your own party's got a sort of a top-down approach because you've got democratic centralism. Is that not a problem too? Because surely the way the people actually do things now is the way you should probably know them to be after the revolution or when whatever.
First of all, I wouldn't agree that we have a top-down approach. What we do is we're not building, you know, a little mini socialism within capitalism. What we're building is an organisation that's going to be capable of taking on capitalism. Because if you look at the weapons it has in terms of, you know, education, the church, the state, the media, they've got a lot of weapons. So we're building an organisation that is able to take on that. Which means, and the basic idea of democratic centralism is that you centralise experience from, you know, that we have, you know, hopefully the best trade unionists, the best community activists, the best student activists, and together all of those experiences put together, and let's put those experiences together and democratically choose then all of us, all of our forces, to the point of attack. Let's agree what we're going to do and then implement it. And I think, I mean, that has proved very successful for us in relation to struggles like, you know, struggle against the water charges, struggle against the exploitation of gamma workers, you know, the assistance we've given to the Irish Ferries workers, those kind of things.
But then it doesn't leave for much room for anybody who decides to go off on their own tangent and actually disobey party headquarters or the party democratic ruling. It's majority rule.
If it's majority rule, exactly. That if someone disagrees with the majority of the party, they're free to argue for their position and try and change the minds of the majority.
Within the party?
Within the party, exactly.
But outside?
No. It's like in a strike situation. Say if you have your majority workers who vote to go on strike and a minority vote against going on strike, should they have the right to go and cross the picket line? In our opinion, they shouldn't, because by doing so, they negate the, you know, I mean, the democratic vote of the majority to go on strike because they make the strike ineffectual. So it's more effective for us to organise this way. We're not saying that social society wouldn't be organised, you know, in a democratic centralist manner. Everyone wouldn't have to do what the majority agreed to, who would be free to make their own decisions.
So, James O'Brien, can you tell us why there has to be an anarchist organisation? Surely people should, if your system of people associating whenever they feel like it would work, why would you need something called the Workers' Solidarity Movement?
The Workers' Solidarity Movement is there to popularise the ideas of anarchism. Ideas just don't float down off the trees. They're really material things that should be transmitted from...
Ideas are material things?
Yeah, and... the Workers' Solidarity Movement is just a small part in that, really. We'd like to help generalise people's experiences, because in people's daily lives that they come up against the reality of hierarchical and capitalist society.
But when you speak about disseminating ideas, is there not a little bit of elitism in that? In that, for instance, somebody's grandfather may have been quite anarchist in the way he carried on, the way he helped their neighbours with their cattle and all the rest of it.
Sure,
and, and even in everyday life where people queue up for a bus stop, anarchism may be everywhere without them people having to be told about it and said, this is anarchism.
Well, it's not quite everywhere, you see. For example, it isn't in the upper reaches of the American government if they go around invading other countries, or it isn't in the upper reaches of the Irish government if they start wrecking the health service. While in their daily lives, they're quite anarchist oriented, and I'd say there's an intrinsic capability achieving anarchism, but it's also a large part of life where there's a hierarchical organisation, and that's what we see as the problem.
But maybe some would say that as individuals, they may quite well be as anarchist as anybody else, which the system has turned them, no matter how temporarily, into something else, or maybe whatever property they have. But let me ask Paul Murphy. Actually, I'll get back to you on that, James, because I know but just your mobile is breaking up too. But Paul, can I ask you as well, what is meant by revolution? I mean, the Socialist Party, for instance, stand candidates in elections. I mean, I don't think the WSM would ever do that.
No. What we mean by revolution is... basically, the actions of the majority in society, the working class, mass movements on the streets, strike action, taking over factories. They're the kind of actions we mean. I mean, we stand candidates for the Dáil, and we use that not because we necessarily think, you know, if you got 166 TDs, would you be able to create socialism? Because there's evidence suggests that you wouldn't be able to, like in Chile in 1973, say, you know, Allende came to power with a majority and tried to implement socialism to some extent through, you know, capitalist parliament, and what happened was that the capitalists don't really have any respect for their own parliament, and they went outside of it. You know, there's a CIA organised coup that ended up with Pinochet in power and thousands and tens of thousands of people being slaughtered. So we use the parliament as a, you know, like I think Joe does very well, as a, you know, a tribune for our ideas, as a chance to, in a sense, expose the lack of democracy in society. Like, you know, when Joe was put in jail for opposing the bin tax when he's an elected representative, I think that shows something about society to a lot of people.
Is there a difference though, Paul, because we're running out of time, is there a difference though that socialism seems to be quite reactive against various ideas and policies, where anarchism tends to try to create its own positive space where things are done differently?
So I wouldn't agree with that, because that's an argument that we get into on stores and stuff a lot. People say you're very, very negative. But in fact, what we're saying is very, very positive. We have something very positive to say about, you know, ordinary working class people. We think they have the power to transform society, that, you know, and that society can be built anew, and ordinary people don't need the bosses to tell us what to do, that we can democratically decide, you know, and organise factories and whatever. And for us, that is something enormously positive about people's strength and own power.
So James O'Brien, you'd never think about running for the Dáil yourself?
No, I wouldn't wait. Trust myself, if I was elected. I don't think I should be.
Just not even to disseminate ideas and use it as a tribune.
No, because it's too dangerous. Sure, that it does work to some extent, and Joe Higgins is probably the best member of the Dáil, it's true. But in the long term, all the evidence suggests for the last 150 years that once you go down that road, you either become co-opted or you become dictators, and that's a major problem for anarchists. Especially becoming dictators. But just on a point of the space anarchists create, anarchists are quite interested in creating the new world and the old. We don't think people are just going to switch like that straight away, that the more they get used to organising themselves in the here and now, the better they'll be able to run society directly after a revolution. So that's why we would see it pretty important that things are organised in a directly democratic manner now, rather than, we'll say, something like the SP does in a democratic centralist manner.
Well, I'm afraid we've got to leave it there. I mean, I'd like to ask Paul Murphy about the anarchist heart against the socialist head and this idea of, because they can be so much vivacity because they accept a lot of what is there right now as well. It's a different type of revolution. Maybe this could go on for a long time. If you're interested, you can go on Saturday to Kildare Street. What's it called?
You're in the Kildare Hotel.
Okay, and what time is it starting?
Two o'clock.
2 o'clock, okay, that's brilliant. And I expect it to be free in the social
system. It is, yeah.
Okay, nice one.
And, very much.
Okay, and this has been Majority World, and from me, Robbie Sinnott, have a good one, and thanks to everybody for contributing, thanks to everybody for listening, you indeed, and thanks to, very much to John Doyle, who's done desk, as he always does. The programme originally went out between 4:30 and 5:30 on a Thursday evening. You can hear it again between 9 and 10 on a Friday morning on Near FM 101.6, or you can hear it podcast on indiemedia.ie. So until next time, have a good one.
Community Radio for Northeast Dublin, Near FM 101.6.